Yeah, so it's 8 o'clock. Perhaps Zavajda, we can start now, and if other people join, I can add them as I see them.
Okay, sounds good. So, in the Centenary Edition, what page are we on? It's a paragraph beginning, "Our mistake is that in trying to define the indefinable."
It's page 393 on the PDF.
393?
Yes.
Okay. So this is the chapter, The Eternal and the Individual. And the paragraph begins, "Our mistake is that in trying to define the indefinable." So in this part of the chapter, Sri Aurobindo is continuing to consider the problem of contradictions. And the contradictions arise due to a variety of reasons, and he'll go into a clearer analysis of that later. But the primary reason comes because of the experience, sensory experience that we have of being separated individuals. So we find our experience is one in which our senses give us the evidence of entirely separated entities. But at the same time, we see that these entities have relations, not only relations of difference, but relations of sameness. In other words, there are commonalities. These commonalities can be properties that we see are repeated in a number of instances or a number of different, classes as well. Or they may be correspondences. In other words, we may find that one entity of a certain class or order looks in some senses similar to another entity. A vessel, a fruit. They seem to be containers. And in that sense, they are common to, they have some morphological commonness with all kinds of containers. So this is a certain type of commonality, a way of reducing the irredeemable variety of the cosmos that comes to us in our experience. And another kind of commonality is the commonality of laws. We find that objects very different from each other yet behave in similar ways when subject to similar laws. And we start seeking for those laws. These are all ways by which we try to overcome an intrinsic intuition that we carry within ourselves, that though this world presents an appearance of complete radical difference, separation, yet there is something which is uniting everything. Yet there is a single unity. We seek for that unity, which we can't find in our empirical experience. But we find glimpses of it in our mental experience. When we look for correspondences, when we look for laws, we perceive things which repeat themselves. So these are two levels at which contradictions occur. Sri Aurobindo, in this chapter and elsewhere in his work, makes a strong case theologically for what is called Trinitarianism. That is the simultaneous and co-evil co-presence of three types of realities, two of which are often distinct. In other words, they are in opposition to each other. And a third one which sort of overcomes that opposition. So this Trinitarianism is present in everything that we experience and is in fact the basis of any manifestation. A manifestation is one in which the absolute infinity of being is configured in a certain way so as to make certain relations possible. Which relations and the laws of those relations constitute the ontology of that manifestation. So, in any kind of manifestation, we have to consider that there's going to be a self-limitation, either through a kind of order of the infinite reality, or through a kind of self-containment of the infinite in finites. So we find that these kinds of self-limitations, both these kinds of self-limitations, become the basis of the kind of cosmos in which we find ourselves. So the Trinity in the Trinitarian conception, as Sri Aurobindo is developing it in this part of the chapter, is the absolute, the cosmic, and the individual. The absolute is that which is the only thing there is. It has become everything else. Everything else can only be understood in terms of the absolute. All other things are relatives which are explained by this absolute. All relatives are self-relations of the absolute. And so we find that the absolute is the only thing there is in substance. It's the one substance that has modulated itself into every other appearance. And it is the only thing there is in force. It is the one force that has applied itself in different degrees in every structure, and thereby resulted in the kinds of activities that we see and the relations we see in the cosmos. So we find these three, the absolute as the root and the only substance and force of all things. The cosmos as the self-differentiation of the absolute and the self-relations of the absolute taken as one. So, if we take reality or the absolute as a radical infinity, it means that this is an infinity to which there is no way in which we can describe, put a limit to its descriptions. Anything that can be said of it. Anything that cannot be said because it is not known can also be said of it. So, this is an absolute infinity. Then we can think about orders of infinity. In other words, that absolute infinity can appear to itself in a certain form. Mathematically, we can think about orders of infinity as, say, the set of odd numbers or the set of natural numbers. Each one of these sets is an infinity, but yet by self-definition it has limited itself and allowed out of its self-definition certain other infinities. So if we have a similar case with the cosmos. We can see that there is a certain type of self-arrangement, a disposition of the infinite. A disposition in which we find an ordering of levels or stages of consciousness. That there seems to be an intelligence that has, projected a stage-wise unfoldment. So that becomes a certain type of self-limitation, you may say. Then we can find that the other property of the cosmos is its particulation. In other words, it is completely dividable into entities that can be broken down until a point which is indefinable. So these entities, these individuals, also cannot but be infinite. But they take on the presentation, self-presentation of finites, because that makes it possible for a world of relations to found itself. That becomes the foundation stone, the founding block of a world of relations, separation. Hence, we can talk about these entities as, you know, finite self-presentations that are unlimited in potential. In other words, each one of us is an unlimited finite. Similarly, the cosmos can be thought about or thought of as something which appears to be limited. That is, it has a limitation in the way in which the infinite is self-ordered. But at the same time, it is ultimately infinite. So it's just as in the case of the individual, we can think of an unlimited finite. In the case of the cosmos, we can think of a limited infinite. See, an infinite that has got a certain self-limitation on it. And the absolute can be thought of as an unlimited infinite. So these are the three kinds of infinities that need to coexist for a manifestation of the kind in which we find ourselves. A manifestation which has an ordering principle from lesser to greater degrees of consciousness, as well as a combining principle in which these various orders are self-presented as limited entities or finite entities, not limited. A limited finite would be what we take ourselves to be under the impress of our sensory experience. In other words, the ego self is the limited finite. The true self, the psychic self, is the unlimited finite. The cosmic self is the limited infinite, and the absolute being is the unlimited infinite. So this is the foundation of what Sri Aurobindo is presenting here in talking about the eternal and the individual, and showing between these two poles this kind of a Trinitarian conception, making it possible for a world of relations and a evolution, an evolutionary relational cosmos. If there's any comments, questions, let's discuss it and then move.
Before we read, I just want to ask Justin, are you able to hear us? I figured you had some problems. Are you able to hear us now?
I am able to hear you now.
Okay, perfect. So, shall we start reading with our mistake, Devashista?
Yeah, with our mistake.
John Robert, would you like to start?
Yes, I'll start. Our mistake is that in trying to define the indefinable, we think we have succeeded when we have described by an all-exclusive negation this absolute, which we are yet compelled to conceive of as the supreme positive and the cause of all positives. It is not surprising that so many acute thinkers with their eye on the facts of being and not on verbal distinctions should be driven to infer that the absolute is a fiction of the intelligence, an idea born of words and verbal dialectics, a zero, non-existent, and to conclude then an eternal becoming is the only truth of our existence. The ancient sages spoke indeed of Brahman negatively. They said of it, neti neti, it is not this, it is not that. But they took care also to speak of it positively. They said of it too, it is this, it is that, it is all. For they saw that to limit it either by positive or negative definitions was to fall away from its truth. Brahman, they said, is matter, is life, is mind, is supermind, is cosmic delight, is Satchitananda. Yet it cannot really be defined by any of these things, not even by our largest conception of Satchitananda. In the world as we see it, for our mental consciousness, however high we carry it, we find that to every positive there is a negative. But the negative is not a zero. Indeed, whatever appears to us as zero is packed with force, teeming with power of existence, full of actual or potential contents. Neither does the existence of the negative make its corresponding positive non-existent or an unreality. It only makes the positive an incomplete statement of the truth of things, and even, we may say, of the positive's own truth. For the positive and the negative exist not only side by side, but in relation to each other and by each other. They complete and would to the all-view, which a limited mind cannot reach, explain one another. Each by itself is not really known. We only begin to know it in its deeper truth when we can read into it the suggestions of its apparent opposite. It is through such a profounder Catholic intuition and not by exclusive logical oppositions that our intelligence ought to approach the absolute.
So here we find Sri Aurobindo is looking at the problem that he often takes up of a description of the divine or of the radical infinity of the divine, what he calls the absolute, in terms of an all-exclusive negation. Because this, what is otherwise called negative theology, in looking for the absolute by refusing reality to the limited, progressively moving towards greater affirmations only to negate them, so that one might arrive at a transcendental, an utter transcendental, that cannot be limited by any of the ways in which we can describe this cosmos. So that has been the seeking of the absolute, because it has been supposed that the absolute is without relations, and hence we have to arrive at it by overpassing our world of finites and relations. And the two major philosophies related to this that he has in mind are the Buddhist and the Advaitin ways of thinking. So for the Buddhist, there is, as he says, that all-exclusive negation that goes towards a description of the absolute that is in negative terms. And Buddhism itself will complicate its own formulation sufficiently so that it will leave the question as to whether there is something positive on the other side of this radical negation. It will leave this question in a, what today we will call an aporetic domain. In other words, a domain that cannot be resolved by the mind. So, is there something on the other side of this vast negation? And the implication is that, yes, there is something, but whatever it is, it cannot be understood so long as we experience things through the modality that we commonly use in this cosmos. In the Hindu terminology, it would be the ignorance, avidya, the modality of the avidya. But the Buddhists don't make that distinction between the ignorance and the knowledge. And so for them, it is just an illusion. Now, Shankara interpreted the Upanishads in a similar way, but instead of defining it through the all negation, he defined it through the absolute affirmation. In other words, he was saying that whatever we experience that is limited, finite, and can actually give a form, however great, to the absolute, cannot be absolute. But there is an absolute, and that absolute can only be experienced if we negate all these finites and these limited formulations. We will arrive at something which is absolute, which cannot be defined. So, to these two, there is a third position which may say that neither of them is really true, because we are starting from an assumption. If we look at it from an empirical point of view, we are starting from an assumption, or at best an intuition, that there is something infinite, something radically infinite. But that may only be a wish. It may be a wish that arises because we don't have it. Somewhere the limitation of finite lives and separation is experienced by us as a suffering. And hence, we crave that which surpasses that, which is an absolute transcendence. But it may be that such a transcendence doesn't exist, that we are in a world of pure becoming. And the Buddhists sort of look at it like that in their explanation of the cosmos. They say essentially that if there is something on the other side of a supreme negation, we don't have any ability to know it. But what we can say of the cosmos is that everything is process here. There is no substance, there is no entity. Substance and entity are appearances of process. And process is kept in place through desire. But desire has no foundation. Its foundation is an illusory death of some kind. Hence, if we can rub out the seed of desire in ourselves, then the process comes to an end. And there is a escape from the cosmos. But is there a being, a sense of being there? And Buddhism will draw its agnostic blank at that point. Some will say, no, there is nothing. As it says here, there is only becoming. And some will say, no, there is something, but we cannot say anything about it. So, there is a certain truth to that kind of approach. Or to the approach, as Sri Aurobindo is saying, that affirms and negates, and affirms a greater affirmation and negates that too. So for the Trinitarian point of view, or from the Trinitarian point of view, the absolute or the transcendent is something which will always remain indefined, undefined, because of its radical infinity. No manifestation will fully be able to manifest it. So that it leaves us in a kind of cosmos which is open-ended, which will never cease to reveal new things. So this is the reason why in the project of knowledge, which is what the Upanishads are all about, the whole field of knowledge has been divided into the known, the unknown, and the unknowable. It's that third category that acknowledges the radical infinity of the Absolute. That there is something that escapes all our knowledge and that leads ever forward. That also implies that it is the basis of an evolution without end. But what Sri Aurobindo is pointing to over here is that, yes, there is a radical infinity into which we can escape while blotting out the cosmos and the individual. But that does not satisfy another kind of infinity, which is that which has become this cosmos. See, that same absolute infinity has become this cosmos and all its entities. Can we have an experience in which we experience that same absolute consciousness, not only free of the cosmos and its individuals, but as including the cosmos, as having become the cosmos and all its individuals? Is it possible to maintain these three dimensions, the dimension of the absolute, the cosmic, and the individual, all together and at once in a single experience? This is the point he's trying to make, and he's saying, yes, it's possible to negate and get out of the cosmos and the individual, but it's also possible to realize that this cosmos and the individuals in it are nothing other than a self-presentation of the Absolute, and the Absolute can be known in itself and in its self-presentations.
Devashish,
yes.
I always seem to ask the same question, which is, when you discuss Sri Aurobindo and then Buddhism or Advaita or Shankara, I always ask the question of, Sri Aurobindo comes to seemingly a different conclusion with this Trinitarianism. And I always ask, is there some other tradition that either takes that as their truth and evolving it forward, or someone or some tradition that is at the same time of Sri Aurobindo? It always seems like there's Sri Aurobindo and then not too much similarity of other traditions or other philosophies that get this three-dimensional aspect of the absolute, cosmic, and individual.
No, actually there are Margaret, but the point is that often we lose sight of them, and then they're not sufficiently developed. They're not sufficiently, developed in all their terms. I'll come to who are the others in a moment, but I'd say that one of the reasons why there is a sense that Sri Aurobindo is saying something new which others haven't said before is because of the way in which he has related all the terms. And particularly because his entire philosophy hinges on the dimension of time. That, as a matter of fact, this unknowable unfoldment forever of the being that is radically infinite, but ordered, self-ordered in a certain way in this cosmos, that kind of self-unfoldment is an evolution of consciousness. And this idea of an evolution of consciousness has been underplayed in at least all the Indian philosophies, where they talk more about eternal division between a realm of ignorance and a realm of the absolute. So the cosmos and all its creatures are, you know, are doomed to an eternal ignorance over here. In the same way you find in Christianity the notion of the fall. So the fall, in a sense, though the Indian philosophies, one could say they don't believe in an original sin, yet they also ultimately empower a certain kind of fall. Now, why that fall took place, they are not so concerned about. It ultimately becomes one of the moods of God. But nevertheless, that particular mood of God is not seen as something that will change. It is seen as something that will always remain, one in which the self-presentation of finites bound by discrete, you know, sort of portions of time is the chronic condition of being. So all we can think of is understand how to get out of it, how to experience something better, or to accept it as it is. See, nobody else has thought that this chronic condition is something that can be changed here. See, so that is one of the problems. But the other reason why, as you're saying, why Sri Aurobindo takes so much effort to keep trying to, you know, explain Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta as different from what he's saying, is that particularly these two sort of Indic standpoints have become the most argued standpoints in Indic philosophy. See, the other standpoints are not talked about so much. Partly the reason is that logical thinkers in the Indian tradition itself have privileged these kinds of philosophies because they seem to be more logical than a more poetic theology or philosophy. The other reason is that apart from Indian thinkers, with the British or Western discovery of India, they took much more easily to these philosophies because it seemed to be more logical, again for the same reason. They found it easier to explain and understand. But if we look at other schools, popular Hinduism, for example, where people don't understand what they're doing, but they're actually, to a large extent, following a kind of philosophy which is more, you know, in tune with what Sri Aurobindo is saying. In other words, it's not an idealism. An idealism would make a distinction between a spirit and a matter. Okay, and spirit has entered matter, or spirit enlivens matter, and it leaves matter, etc. This is more a monism in which there is only one being, but that being is self-manifest in different degrees of consciousness and different variations of consciousness. So that a piece of stone can manifest the entirety of God. Okay? So that kind of a approach which becomes conscious of the presence of the divine behind the cosmos and in all its creatures is a better or easier fit to what Sri Aurobindo is saying, this Trinitarianism that we are talking about, which refuses to break any one of these three terms in seeking for any one of the others.
Thank you, Debashish.
See, also we may say that if you compare it to, you can compare it to other religions, you can compare it to Christianity And many people have seen in mystical Christianity things that are closer to what Sri Aurobindo is talking about than even in Hinduism. So there are ways by which, you know, the hints and glimpses of the past in mystical literatures and experience can be seen in the light of what Sri Aurobindo is talking about here. But also it needs to be understood that what he's talking about does bring in certain configurations to our understanding that have not been considered or given that kind of importance before.
Thank you.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yeah. Did you ask somebody to read, Sham?
No, I can go next. The positives of the Absolute are its various statements of itself to our consciousness. Its negatives bring in the rest of its absolute positivity, by which its limitation to these first statements is denied. We have, to begin with, its large primary relations, such as the infinite and the finite, the conditioned and unconditioned, the qualitied and unqualitied. In each pair, the negative conceals the whole power of the corresponding positive, which is contained in it and emerges from it. There is no real opposition. We have, in a less subtle order of truths, the transcendent and the cosmic, the universal and the individual. Here we have seen that each member of these pairs is contained in its apparent opposite. The universal particularizes itself in the individual. The individual contains in himself all the generalities of the universal. The universal consciousness finds all itself by the variations of numberless individuals, not by suppressing variations. The individual consciousness fulfills all itself when it is universalized into sympathy and identity with the cosmic, not by limiting itself in the ego. So too, the cosmic contains in all itself and in each thing in it the complete immanence of the transcendent. It maintains itself as the world being by the consciousness of its own transcendent reality. It finds itself in each individual being by the realization of the divine and transcendent in that being and in all existences. The transcendent contains, manifests, constitutes the cosmos, and by manifesting it, manifests or discovers, as we may say in the old poetic sense of that word, its own infinite harmonic varieties. But even in the lower orders of the relative, we find this play of negative and positive. And through the divine reconciliation of its terms, not by excising them or carrying their opposition to the bitter end, we have to arrive at the Absolute. For there in the Absolute, all this relativity, all this varying rhythmic self-statement of the Absolute, finds not its complete denial, but its reason for existence and its justification. Not its conviction as a lie, but the force and principle of its truth. Cosmos and individual go back to something in the Absolute, which is the true truth of individuality, the true truth of cosmic being, and not their denial and conviction of their falsity. The Absolute is not a skeptical logician denying the truth of all his own statements and self-expressions, but an existence so utterly and so infinitely positive that no finite positive can be formulated which can exhaust it or bind it down to its definitions.
So here we see Sri Aurobindo is spelling it out further, and he's actually outlining some of these contradictions, the most foundational ones, the basic ones, And he's pointing to the fact that each one of these positives is limited, because as soon as we give it a certain characteristic, then that characteristic's opposite hides what it is not, and also contains the infinity of the radical infinite. So you find that, as a matter of fact, every negation is needed to complete the infinity of these whatever we want to call these categories. See, that they seem to be finite, but they're actually, their infinities are only realized if we negate them. See? So this is how we have to look at reality, to arrive at the absolute by keeping each one of its self presentations and the contradiction of that self presentation together in our consciousness. It is not by negating one in favor of the other, but by being able to arrive at the root by empowering both, by affirming both, that this is done. So this paragraph actually, from that point of view, is very similar to the central thesis of the Isha Upanishad, which is why Sri Aurobindo made that little Upanishad into the cornerstone of his philosophy. In fact, the Life Divine was the name of the commentary that he started writing to that the Upanishad. And the central point in that Upanishad is exactly this, connected with the avidya and the vidya, the ignorance and the knowledge, that it is not by giving up one for the other that the absolute is obtained. By giving up one for the other, in either case, is an exclusivity of knowledge that is actually being called a darkness by that Upanishad. So to go only for the negation of the cosmos and all finites is, according to it, an even greater darkness than to delve into the world of finites and lose the infinite in it. This strong position is being taken by it because in Sri Aurobindo's interpretation, our normal human experience is one that moves from the fragmented towards the united, from the limited towards the unlimited. And so, those who are engrossed in the world of finites are within the cycle of evolution, and their own acts will cause the growth of their consciousness towards that which exceeds these limited formulations. But those who have rejected the limited formulations on principle, by affirming a supreme transcendence either of nirvana or of a Satchidananda outside of the cosmos, they have lost the meaning of life's birth, Sri Aurobindo says. They have escaped from the cosmos, but they missed the point of exactly what was the nature of the divine manifesting as the cosmos. So this is the reason why Sri Aurobindo is going through so much, you know, so many paragraphs, making it clear that there's another way of looking at these contradictions, not as contradictions that cancel each other out and can only be overcome by their annulment in an absolute, but contradictions that complete each other and are necessary for the self-manifestation of that absolute, and need to be experienced in that Trinitarian form.
Debashish, was Was Sri Aurobindo influenced at all by Hegelian philosophy? Was that because this talk of the positive and the negative has such a, in England there definitely was a movement toward a study of Hegelian philosophy. Is there an influence of Hegel in these passages or Hegel's study in that time?
Yeah, Justin, I think there is no doubt that there is some Hegelian background to this. I think the case has been made by a number of scholars, and some of them have, I think, overmade the case as well. For example, I think this is one of the positions that Robert McDermott takes, that Sri Aurobindo is drawing heavily from Hegel, or that at least he was very familiar with Hegel from his studies in Cambridge. He did read Hegel, he did read Kant, he read a lot of the Greek philosophy in Greek, Plato and Aristotle, etc. My take on it, Justin, is that he's more of a Nietzschean than a Hegelian. I think he reconciles the two in the sense that, yes, he does believe in a kind of cosmic evolution that is being guided by these processes of contradiction. But where he differs from the Hegelian view is that this kind of cosmic evolution in Hegel is carried out by the time spirit, by the zeitgeist. Its experiments are the experiments of principles that underlie the cosmos and its material reality. In other words, consciousness is the agent that is carrying out its own experiments and its evolution. But in his case, I think what happened is that if we look at Nietzsche, we see that this was something that Nietzsche reacted against in a big way. And he did this because this kind of view of cosmic history gives little position to human agency. So that we can say that in a way, that's what Marx was trying to do when he was putting Hegel on his head and saying, no, you know, Hegel has got it wrong. We have to ground it in materialism. But Nietzsche wasn't doing that. What Nietzsche was saying is that much greater than whatever cosmic forces are trying to work their own kind of, you know, destinies out is human destiny and creature destiny. In other words, creatures have a say in what they become, and that is basically through the primordial will to power that is active in every individual. So Sri Aurobindo's philosophy includes the fact that there are these grand negations that are churning, as it were, the cosmic evolution in its path. But even more important than that for him is the relationship of that to the individual as will, as the ability to aspire and exceed the formulations of the cosmos at any time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Devashish, would you say a little bit more about the life divine starting off as a commentary on the Isha?
Yeah.
I mean, like the historicity of, I mean, is it in the Arya or?
No, I think he started doing that work. Of course, in the Arya, he was already writing the life divine. So the whole life divine comes in the Arya. But he started prior to that, I believe in Baroda. We can see in the Isha Upanishad notes. I believe he began it in Baroda, but he began writing this longer, interpretation, commentary, which is contained in that volume, in fact, the volume on the Isha Upanishad. The Upanishads are out in two volumes, as you know. And I think the first one is the Isha Upanishad, and it has all his different writings on the Isha Upanishad. There you'll find the ones that he started as the life divine. And basically the point he's bringing out there is exactly this point, that it's not for an experience of the absolute which takes us outside the cosmos, but for a life divine, in other words, a cosmic existence in which the absolute is experienced by us in life, is what the goal of existence is, and that's what this Upanishad is really talking about.
Thank you.
It might be useful to look at that, and I'll also take a look at it. Maybe next time we can say a few words on this stage of the life divine, you know, when he was writing the commentary to the Isha Upanishad.
Yes, I would appreciate that.
Joanna, would you like to read next?
Sure, as long as I can find my cursor to unmute my phone.
We can hear you, so you've unmuted it already.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. It is evident that if such is the truth of the Absolute, we cannot bind it either by our law of contradictions. That law is necessary to us in order that we may posit partial and practical truths, think out things clearly, decisively, and usefully, classify, act, deal with them effectively for particular purposes in our divisions of space, distinctions of form and property, moments of time. It represents a formal and strongly dynamic truth of existence in its practical workings, which is strongest in the most outward term of things, the material, but becomes less and less rigidly binding as we go upward in the scale, mount on the more subtle rings of the ladder of being. It is especially necessary for us in dealing with material phenomena and forces. We have to suppose them to be one thing at a time, to have one power at a time, and to be limited in their ostensible and practically effective capacities and properties. Otherwise, we cannot deal with them. But even there, as human thought is beginning to realize, the distinctions made by the intellect and the classifications and practical experiments of science, while perfectly valid in their own field and for their own purpose, do not represent the whole or the real truth of things, whether of things in the whole or of the thing by itself, which we have classified and set artificially apart, isolated for separate analysis. By that isolation, we are indeed able to deal with it very practically, very effectively, and we think at first that the effectiveness of our action proves the entire sufficient truth of our isolating and analyzing knowledge. Afterwards, we find that by getting beyond it, we can arrive at a greater truth and a greater effectivity.
So here, as he's pointing out, that this is really a contradiction or a paradox of our existence, which arises because of the nature or the practical nature of our experience and our action. The fact is that we need to have this kind of view and are kind of constituted to have this kind of experience, the experience of finites, because that's the way in which, that's the nature of the cosmos that we have to deal with and to manifest in. It's like one of the Upanishads says that the doors of the senses were fastened, the senses were fastened with their doors outwards. So it's this fastening that has happened, that there is some power, a tapas, a will, that is the will of the Absolute, that has configured itself in a certain way. That's the whole thing about the disposition or the self-configuration or orientation, which is the cosmic self-limitation of the Absolute. And that entire process is done so that there may be the movement from the one to the many and the interaction of the many forming the basis of the life divine. And so we find that that's the experience that's given to us, the experience of separates and of limits. But we find that the contradiction of between that and this idea of wholes, of ecologies, and of essences, you know, these kinds of ideas are things that the mind naturally separates and treats as contradictions. So you have either one or the other. But what he's pointing out is that there can be another kind of thinking that affirms the practical necessity of this separation in time and space, but at the same time can move towards a more holistic view that ultimately ends up becoming the view or the experience of the one in many forms. This actually requires a jump to another dimension. And Sri Aurobindo is not explicitly saying that in this particular paragraph, but it is clear that the coexistence of these dimensions, the dimension of what we call ignorance, in which time and space, location, local time and space, determines the basis of our world. While on the other hand, exists another dimension that we may call the cosmic, and another dimension which we may call the Absolute that he's talking about, which are also forms of experience that can coexist with this form of experience in which we empower a practical reality limited in space and time. And that's the invitation of these paragraphs. He's basically saying, can we aspire to have this kind of completion of knowledge where our practical experience of objects limited in time and place, in space and in shape, form, and appearance and disappearance, is something which coexists with a sense of the one cosmos in which everything is a part and the one being that has become all things. This paragraph also is reminiscent of many of the new discoveries of science that are going on at the time that Sri Aurobindo is writing, and that have actually become more prevalent in our present-day understanding. You know, the whole notion of, the distinction between a world in which the laws of of physics fails because, you know, measurement implies a certain, you know, way of perceiving. Measurement itself is premised on existence, local existences in time and space. And this kind of measurement itself presupposes a reality in which things are separated and positioned, and that there is a gap between that kind of reality and the reality in which, you know, that disappears into something else, which gap is not easy to explain, but which exists and which has been postulated in modern science.
So there was just on the last line when he says, afterwards we find that by getting beyond it and so on. So when he says getting beyond it, would you say that's like a specific point in time where a particular individual gets beyond it? Or would you say that it's more like a continuum where one increasingly finds this demarcation ambiguous?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think both are true to some extent. In other words, that by the faculties that are given to us, we may conduct meditations in which our sense of the connectedness of things increases. And that happens too. I mean, we start without any knowledge of the interconnectedness of things, but with personal experience, we start becoming aware that there's a much more complex functioning going on. That's the more gradual approach. But there is a more discrete approach as well, an approach which is finite, I mean, like proceeds through jumps. And that is that which is related to spiritual experience and the fact that there are different dimensions of experience. So, for example, if one has a major spiritual realization, like, let's say, that of the psychic being, or that of the cosmic being, or that of something even greater, these experiences don't really go away. They actually remain as another dimension. First, hazily, along with whatever one is doing, but gradually with greater, you know, sort of assertiveness, so that one can live there and control the rest of one's life from there. So it's when these kinds of experiences occur that we can talk about a, you know, more wholesale getting beyond and arriving at a greater truth. But that can be prepared by a more complex instrument that has a understanding that is extremely holistic and moves towards unity.
Thank you, Devashish.
At the time, I guess, that he's doing this thinking, quantum physics was just becoming known, and one of the things that that implied that measurement fails is the uncertainty principle, which illustrated that you can't measure the locality or the in time and space completely. You can measure part of it, which really went against the Newtonian idea that everything was local.
Yeah.
So I appreciate your bringing that the awareness of science.
Yeah.
That he includes that.
Yeah, because as you see, he actually specifically references it. He says, but even there, as human thought is beginning to realize, the distinctions made by the intellect and the classification and practical experiments of science, while perfectly valid in their own field and for their own purpose, do not represent the whole or the real truth of things, whether of things in the whole or of the thing by itself, which we have classified and set artificially apart, isolated for separate analysis. See, so he's acknowledging over there that even within science, we have to understand this distinction between the macrocosmos and the microcosmos, or the nanocosmos, where the distinction this of localized objects as against the amorphous unity of things, you know, becomes hazy.
Margaret, would you like to read next?
Oh, yes. The isolation is certainly necessary for first knowledge. A diamond is a diamond, and a pearl a pearl. Each thing of its own class, existing by its distinction from all others, each distinguished by its own form and properties. But each has also properties and elements which are common to both, and others which are common to material things in general. And in reality, each does not exist only by its distinctions, but much more essentially by that which is common to both. And we get back to the very basis and enduring truth of all material things only when we find that all are the same thing, one energy, one substance, or if you like, one universal motion which throws up, brings out, combines, realizes those different forms, these various properties, these fixed and harmonized potentialities of its own being. If we stop short at the knowledge of distinctions, we can deal only with diamond and pearl as they are, fix their values, uses, varieties, make the best ordinary use and profit of them. But if we can get to the knowledge and control of their elements and the common properties of the class to which they belong, we may arrive at the power of making either a diamond or pearl at our pleasure. Go farther still and master that which all material things are in their essence, and we may arrive even at the power of transmutation, which would give the greatest possible control of material nature. Thus the knowledge of distinctions arrives at its greatest truth and effective use when we arrive at the deeper knowledge of that which reconciles distinctions in the unity behind all variations. That deeper knowledge does not deprive the other and more superficial of effectivity nor convict it of vanity. We cannot conclude from our ultimate material discovery that there is no original substance or matter, only energy manifesting substance, or manifesting as substance. That diamond and pearl are non-existent, unreal, only true to the illusion of our senses of perception and action. That the one substance, energy or motion, is the sole eternal truth, and that therefore the best or only rational use of our science would be to dissolve diamond and pearl and everything else that we can dissolve into this one eternal and original reality and get done with their forms and properties forever. There is an essentiality of things, a commonality of things, an individuality of things. The commonality and individuality are true and eternal powers of the essentiality that transcends them both, but the three together and not one by itself are the eternal terms of existence.
So succinctly over here, he is spelling out the central idea of his, what he's trying to get across in these paragraphs, that here, as he says, that this objects, entities that are expressing specific qualities and the variations that are giving distinct identities to all things are the foundation of a manifestation. A manifestation that exists for practical use and for play and for the delight of interactions. And that has not to be lost sight of. But at the same time, it is natural, because that's why, as I said right in the beginning, this is one of the foundational intuitions of the human, that, or why human, of reality itself, of every entity in the cosmos, that while we are experiencing ourselves separate from all other things, confronted by all other things and by the cosmos, that there are profound commonalities and in fact unities that unite us. And knowing that can be of tremendous practical use to us, as well as ultimately true use to us, essential use to us, because that's the only way in which we can explain the question of who we are and of what everything is. It's almost like the answer to the Upanishadic question of the Prashna Upanishad, knowing what can all things be known. This is the question they ask. There are many things to be known, but is there one thing that I can know? And if I know that one thing, I can know all things. So this is the quest of the human. The quest of the human is motivated by exactly this fact that somewhere deep inside us we intuit the fact that there is nothing but one. But all our experience belies that fact. Constantly faced by difference, by variation, by opposition. And so this is the reason why this causes us to either jump towards the one, leaving the many behind, or to cling to the many and to negate the reality of the one. Or to say that both are false and we have to ultimately erase ourselves in something that is indescribable and ineffable. So the point he is making over here very strongly, ending with this, again, as I said, a Trinitarian notion, is that this triple reality, the reality of absolute, cosmos, and individual, are simultaneous and coeval self-appearances of the Supreme. And we have to keep each one of these as the truth that we experience along with the others at the same time. So that's how he ends. There is an essentiality of things. The essentiality of things is the essence, the only thing there is. If we are to kind of break things down to look at their building blocks, the substance that we will arrive at ultimately is the one substance. I mean, the particles can keep, you know, proliferating and ultimately appearing and disappearing, but the one substance is the Brahman, and the one energy is the Shakti, and it's that essence that is all things. Everything is nothing but that one substance and that one energy in different variations, in variant forms. So that is the essentiality of things. Then there is a commonality of things. The commonality of things are the variety of ways in which properties are shared and properties work together to form wholes. That is the commonality of things. And finally, there's the individuality of things. Individuality of things refers to the fact that every self-presentation in the cosmos is radically different from moment to moment and from entity to entity. So these are the three different dimensions, or three different realities or terms, as he says there. But these three together, and not any one by itself, are the eternal terms of existence. This is very important, because this is exactly the foundation of the life divine. Because no divine life would be possible if we had to negate the cosmos. And life would never be divine if we had to negate the transcendent. So how is it possible to come to an experience in which one sees the absolute that has become the cosmos and every entity in it, and participate as an entity in that cosmos and its self-making, while at the same time knowing that one is the one being that has become all this? This is the challenge of the life divine.
Justin, would you like to read next? Sorry, I was muted.
Okay. Very good. This is at the bottom of the PDF of page 396, and then on to 397, I think.
Yes.
This truth, which we can see, though with difficulty and under considerable restrictions, even in the material world where the subtler and higher powers of being have to be excluded from our intellectual operations, becomes clearer and more powerful when we ascend in the scale. We see the truth of our classifications and distinctions, but also their limits. All things, even while different, are yet one. For practical purposes, plant, animal, man are different existences. Yet when we look deeper, we see that the plant is only an animal with an insufficient evolution of self-consciousness and dynamic force. And the animal is a human being in the making. And humankind, her or himself, is that animal, and yet something more of self-consciousness and dynamic power of consciousness that make her or him a human being. And yet again, she or he is the something more which is contained and repressed in her or his being as the potentiality of the divine. She or he is a god in the making. In each of these, plant, animal, human being, God, the eternal, is there containing and repressing her or himself, as it were, in order to make a certain statement of her or his being. Each is the whole eternal concealed. Humankind, her or himself, who takes up all that went before her or him and transmutes it into the term of humankind, manhood, womanhood, is the same individual human being. And yet she or he is all humankind. The universal human being acting in the individual as a human personality. She or he is all, and yet she or he is her or himself and unique. She or he is what she or he is, but she or he is also the past of all that she was or he was, and the potentiality of what, of all that she or he is not. We cannot understand her or him if we look only at her or his present individuality. But we cannot understand her or him either if we look only at her or his commonality, her or his general term of humankind, of being a human being, or go back by exclusion from both to an essentiality of her or his being, in which her or his distinguishing humankind being and her or his particularizing individuality seem to disappear. Each thing is the absolute. All are that one. But in these three terms, always the absolute makes its statement of its developed self-existence. We are not, because of the essential unity, compelled to say that all God's various action and workings are vain, worthless, unreal, phenomenal, illusory, and at the best, and only rational or super-rational, and that the best and only rational or super-rational use we can make of our knowledge is to get away from them. Dissolve our cosmic and individual existence into the essential being and get rid of all becoming as a futility forever.
I just wanted to say that I have a I'm reading a printed version of the Life Divine, and in this one it has all of the human beings are man. So I guess it's been revised.
I think Justin was reading it like that. Were you not, Justin?
Yes, I apologize, but I can't just read gender-exclusive pronouns, so I have to, and I apologize for that. But
I thought it was great. I thought that somebody had actually revised the text.
Interesting.
So here we find that he's taking the same argument further, and he's talking about how the distinctions that we see are also just gradations and variations. Everything is gradation and variation. And this indeed is a certain way by which a meditation can be conducted, where we actually look at things like this, see things in that form, and try to see that the same energy and the same substance are in all things. See, this is what the point is that he's making. And yet, it's important to see that whatever these forms have become or are in self-becoming are also the one that is interacting with the one in a variety of ways. And each one of these ways is part of the play of the one mediated by the evolution of consciousness. So the idea is here that the delight of the play of existence, the delight of the leela of the divine, but not just any kind of leela, not a kind of a play without any logic to it, but a play that is mediated by the divine logic, the logic of the infinite, as he calls it, which is the ordering power of the supermind. That's not something that is like a machine outside of the entities, but an immanent principle that is one and multitudinous at the same time, which is at work and at play in this cosmos and all the self-limited entities within it. So to be able to experience that one being, the Absolute, as he calls it over here, and its self-presentations as the cosmos and other individuals, simultaneously, these three existences, realities, to be experienced simultaneously as the self-becomings of the Absolute is the point to which he's taking us.
If there are no questions, Devajita, maybe we can stop here and continue next time.
Sure.
Yeah, so I'll stop the call and upload the recording very soon. And we'll continue 2 weeks from now.
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you, Devajita.
Thank you,
Thank you, Devajita.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.